Okay, Parshat Chukat has got some very big famous things in it. Of course, the most famous thing is Parah Adumah, so we're not going to touch that. Second of all, there is something that we have talked about in the past, which is Moshe's sin, the rock, and all of that. We're not going to touch that one either. And there is the whole war with Sihon and Og, that we've talked about in different contexts, not as part of Parshat Chukat, but the fact that that opens up the East Bank to us and the implications of that, we're not going to talk about that one either. The reality is Parshat Chukat is a very short parsha, which is chock full. It's just great stuff. Mm-hmm. And one of the really fascinating pieces of it is something that we may touch on at the end, which is on the back page, depending on our time, which is this Shirat HaBe'er, this song that suddenly shows up when Bnei Yisrael come to a well, and they sing, and it's unclear what the song is about, and it's unclear why they're singing, and there's a really bizarre comment of one of the Rishonim that we're going to take a look at, but we're going to look at what is assuredly one of the overlooked pieces in Chukat, only because it gets lost in the spotlights shined on the other things that I just mentioned, which is this little skirmish. I don't know if you can call it more than a skirmish, between some Canaanite king and Bnei Yisrael. Right, and on the face of it, it seems to be a relatively mundane piece that should not raise any sort of issue for us. It's source one on the page. There you go. And this happens immediately after the death of Aharon. So Aharon dies. Moshe and Eleazar come down. Eleazar is decked out in Aharon's bidei kehuna. And the next thing that we hear is Vayishma Haknani Melech Arad Yoshev HaNegev. Now, who is this guy, first of all? So he's Haknani, which tells us that he's some sort of a Canaanite leader. He's Melech Arad. Now, we know that Arad is on the West Bank. We know where Arad is. Arad, by the way, is not far from Tel Arad. In other words, modern-day Arad is very close to the ancient city of Arad, and it's one of the oldest cities that we have in existence. And it goes back to certainly before the period of Yitziat Mitzrayim, because when Bnei Yisrael come in the ill-fated scouting mission that we call the Meraglim, they come up through Arad, and they describe what happens there. So Haknani Melech Arad Yoshev HaNegev. So this puts him firmly as a West Bank king. Kibal Yisrael Derech HaAtarim. What does he hear? He hears that Bnei Yisrael came via the road of the Atarim. Now, an Atar in Aramaic means a location. Matter of fact, in modern Hebrew, it's even used for a website, right? An Atar. But it's a site or a location. Derech HaAtarim, what is that? Unclear, and it's not a road that we've heard of otherwise. We have other roads that we're familiar with. Derech HaShemesh, Derech Eretz Plishtim, Derech HaMelech. We have other roads that we're familiar with. We've never heard of this road before, Derech HaAtarim. But Bnei Yisrael are coming there. Vayilachem b'Yisrael vayishmenu shevi. And for some reason they go to war against us, and they take some captives. I have the famous Midrash that was only one captive, Shevi, but simple shot is they take some captives. So where is this war happening? When is this, meaning when in the context of travels is this war happening? And why do they go to war against us? So the simplest read of it is they go to war against us because we're coming through their territory, because that's a lot of what happens in Chukat. Either in the case of Edom, we go around because God says you can't go to war against them, or in the case of Sihon and Og, when we're told you can go to war against them, we try to go through, they come out, and we fight them, and we go through. So it sounds like we're going through their territory. If we're going through their territory, that means we're already in the West Bank. Now, that's a little strange, because we thought that after the decree of the 38 years, which ends up being 40 years, we spent the whole time south of Israel, and then east of Israel, and then come in via Jericho. But here we suddenly are somewhere at some point in time, evidently towards the end of the travels, we're suddenly in the Negev. What are we doing there? Vayidar Yisrael neder l'Adonai vayomar. So Am Yisrael takes a neder. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean the leader took the neder? Why doesn't it say Moshe did it? Unclear. But there's some sort of a group neder that they take, which is im naton titen etam hazeh biyadi, parenthetically, and totally within the parentheses, but if you look at Nedarim in Tanakh, There are five famous Nedarim in Tanakh, right? And every one of them seems to use this double phrasing. The most famous Neder probably is Chana's Neder. Okay, but so the same thing here. The one that actually violates that seems to be Yaakov's, where he doesn't use the double phrasing, the participle.
What is Yiftach? Is that
what? Yiftach is also an eder, and Yiftach also uses it. Yes, as they use the same phrase in Aton Titen. So they make a deal with God. If you let me beat these people, which means I'll get the captives back, I will v'hacharamti et areihem. What is v'hacharim? V'hacharim means to destroy, but to dedicate. And therefore it becomes cherem. And what's the most famous cherem city in the world? Is Jericho, where Yoshua uttered the oath, the imprecation that anybody who builds Jericho, his children will die, and that it's all cherem. And Achan takes from the cherem, and that's why they can't move forward until they get rid of Achan and get rid of the cherem, etc. All right, parenthetically, the word cherem, which is something that's dedicated to God, it's used all through the end of Sefer Vayikra, the last chapter of Vayikra, Charamim. A cherem, therefore, translates also into that which belongs uniquely to the king, which in Arabic is haram, which, of course, where the English word harem comes from. It's all the same word. So now, Am Yisrael makes a deal. What's the deal? Is that when, if you allow us to win this war, we will ha-charam tiyat arehem, as opposed to what? Like, what else would we do?
Allow us to win or help us to win?
Help us to win. Help us to win. All right? But what else would we do? Of course we'd destroy their cities. The answer is, we would destroy their cities, and then we would move in, and we would take the stuff, and we would use it for ourselves. But what's the deal we're making? If you allow us to win, or you help us to win, thanks. If you help us to win, then we will destroy the cities and dedicate them to you, meaning they'll stay untouched. So okay? Special status of cherem.
Just be destroyed?
What? Yeah.
Destroyed,
which means that means that we'll get our captives back. Right. And we'll save them. But we will not then make these cities for something for use for our own benefit, but they'll just be destroyed cities. Okay? Now, Vayishma Adonai b'kol Yisrael. Famous line, how do you know God listens to the radio? Okay, God listens to the Kol Yisrael. Vayiten et ha-Kanani, vayacharem etem v'tarehem. So he gives over the Kanani, which is a way of saying God helps us beat them. And vayacharem etem v'tarehem. And vayacharem here has to be in Yisrael. Yisrael destroys them and their cities. Vayikrashem ha-makom chorma. Now, the language of this pasuk itself is a little bit stilted, because it's Arehem, which means there are several cities. And what are these cities? These cities sound like they are Arad u'benoteha. Benot ha'ir, banot shel ir, which is a phrase that we find often in Yehoshua, for instance, refers to the suburbs or the outlying appendages of the city that are under the protection of the city. So it sounds like Arad and its suburbs or exurbs are all captured. It sounds like that. Vayikrashem ha-makom chorma, which means?
The whole area.
The whole area then, instead of ha-makomot. So it sounds like the whole area now gets blanketed under the title chorma, and it's untouched, and we don't deal with it at all. And by the way, we don't hear about this place later on in history, except in one instance, which is actually going to shed a lot of light on this. In other words, you would think that if this really were on the West Bank, we would hear later on that when Yehuda conquers its territory and gets Arad, that it stays away from this. It puts a little, yellow tape up, police line, caution, don't cross, don't inherit, you can't touch it. We don't hear about it in that context, but we do hear about it in a different context, which creates a lot of problems for this pasuk. So part of the problem is, when did this happen? Why did this happen? And then that leads also to the big question of where did this happen, which has a lot of impact on how we look at Parshat Chukat. So we'll start with Rashi. Rashi picks up on the famous Midrash in the Gemara, which is the beginning of Rosh Hashanah, and because the Parsha starts with Vayishma HaKanani. Now, what is it that the Kanani heard that caused him to go to war? Simple pshat is, he heard that Bnei Yisrael are coming. It says, Vayishma Yisrael ki Vayisrael. Vayishma HaKanani ki Vayisrael. He heard that they're coming. So it becomes some sort of either a war of opportunity that they're on the move, or a war of defense because they're coming in my direction. That's what he heard. Rashi, quoting the Midrash, says, Mashmua Shama Uva, Shama Shemei Taharon. Now, where's that coming from? The previous parsha in Chukat is the death of Aharon. And there's a famous midrashic development that there were three great gifts that accompanied Bnei Yisrael in the desert. Each one of them was the merit of one of the three members of the family. The Miriam was the source of the Be'er, the rolling well, which is why in our parsha, when Miriam dies, we immediately hear about a thirst crisis. Moshe is the man, which becomes a little bit problematic for something we're actually going to see at the end of the year today. And Aharon is Ananei HaKavod. Now, where do we get that Aharon is Ananei HaKavod? So Miriam and the Be'er we could get from this juxtaposition and all of the associations of Miriam with water, meaning Miriam saves Moshe from the water and Miriam, her most famous moment is singing at the sea. Moshe and the man, you could sort of see the connection, perhaps, but Aharon and Ananei HaKavod is a little bit difficult unless you assume this, which is, the minute Aharon dies, suddenly for the first time we're attacked. For the first time since...
He's the man.
What?
He's the man.
No. Very good. Thank you, Rasta. But the problem is it's circular. Because if you argue that the only way we know that Aharon was the source of the clouds was because in this pasuk, when the clouds disappear, suddenly we're vulnerable. And when Aharon dies, suddenly we're vulnerable. Well, but who says that they're connected at all? That's assuming facts, not in evidence, in order to make it happen. Sort of a violation of petitio principi. So there's a midrashic notion that the clouds of protection are generated by Aharon. When Aharon dies, the clouds are gone, we're vulnerable, and therefore he comes and attacks. But the critical piece of this is that means Rashi is putting this story here. Meaning, Am Yisrael is at Hor HaHar. Hor HaHar is Petra, or thereabouts, on the other side. Now, that's where Aharon supposedly is buried. Aharon dies. And so, what is this king doing? This king is not defending himself. This king is rather coming on the offensive, because everybody in the Middle East knows that Am Yisrael is on their way in, and coming as a preemptive battle, because they saw that the clouds are gone and Am Yisrael suddenly is vulnerable. Okay? All right, that would be the take. The Rashbam and Ibn Ezra and others take a look at the word Ahatarim, which is actually going to help us a lot, but it's going to shift the entire focus of the story away from where Rashi took it. Ha'atarim, the Rashbam points out, we have numerous nouns and also verbs in Hebrew that the first letter is an aleph, where the aleph is a slippery letter that will disappear. So, for instance, you have the word that they all like to quote in, maybe Ezroa, which is an expanded version of Zroa. Or the opposite, the one that Ibn Ezra loves to bring, is Lo Yahel Sham Aravi is Lo Ye'ehal, meaning Yahel is a contracted version of Ye'ehal, which is to make a tent. An example of that, something we learned many years ago here in Shmuel, in the story of Shaul's war against Amalek, is Vayarev Sham Banachal, which means Vaye'erog, meaning he set an ambush. And the first letter is an aleph. The aleph disappears. Aleph, light letter, disappears. So he says, do you know what Atarim is? Atarim is simply an expanded version of Tarim. What's Derech HaTarim? The route taken by the 12 scouts. Tarim et Haaretz. Okay? So now that means suddenly that our story happened when? Our half story happened 38 years ago. In other words, he hears that Am Yisrael is coming in this path, and they go to war. And by the way, now location-wise, it works perfectly because where do we go? We went past Arad. And suddenly, we hear, but that means that this story is like the story we talked about with Koshesh, and like we talked about Korach, not the Dathan Aviram part, but Korach last week. The story is a story that happened many years earlier. And why is it in Chukat? Maybe it's in Chukat because Chukat may represent Sefer Melchamot Hashem, which is mentioned in Chukat. And like Ibn Ezra says, it's a book that they kept of all the wars of the Lord, meaning all a record of all of these battles. So here's one of the battles that gets mentioned in here. Now, we yet have a third approach, which is similar, but not exactly the same, and the motivation then becomes different. What happens at the very end of the quote-unquote Meraglim episode? I say quote-unquote because, of course, they're never called Meraglim. But at the end of that episode, the very end, after Moshe tells the decree, the 10 guys have been smitten dead, everybody else heard the decree that they're going to have to wait a whole generation, they're going to die in the desert, the kids are going to come in, etc. What do the vanguard, what do the Lebedik guys do?
Not feeling
Say, we're going to go. We're going to go. We feel bad. We're trying to make up for it. We're going to go conquer the land. Right? Moshe says, don't go. Hashem's not with you. And Vayapilu al Tahara, and these are the Mapilim we don't like. Of course, we like the Mapilim from 1946 to 48. But these are the Mapilim we don't like, and they all get wiped out. Parenthetically, take a look at it in source 4. So we want to make up for it. And they go, etc., etc. Take a look at the last pasuk. Okay? Hayoshev Bahar Hahu, Vayakum Vayaktum Ad Hachorma. So, what does that mean? Does it mean that when this group of maverick fighters went in, they got beaten and smashed all the way until destruction, and Chorma is an adjective of force of sorts? Or does it mean there's a location called Chorma where they get destroyed? So Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, the Talmud of Rabbeinu Tam, says that's the story that's happening here. That this story is happening not at the beginning of the quote-unquote Meraglim episode, but after that aftermath. And of course, it makes a lot of sense because here you have a whole group of guys who go and they get attacked, and the story is that, oh yeah, but some of them got taken captive, and then Am Yisrael makes a deal, and Am Yisrael comes in, which of course raises the big question. Why don't you tell this whole story there? In other words, at the Mapilim story, say, Mapilim went, they got wiped out, some were taken captive, Am Yisrael made a nether, Am Yisrael was given help by God to beat them, got the captives back, and called the place Chorma. Well, the answer is actually pretty straightforward. Because the Torah is not interested in telling you a whole war story. The Torah is interested in teaching you lessons. And the lessons of that piece are, you go to war with God. When you go to war without God, you're not going to war successfully. And therefore the Mapilim lose. This story belongs to a separate piece, even though it's the same. It's another side of the same story, and happened at the same time. So that's yet another approach that we have, understanding what the story is. However, there's a problematic pasuk, as I mentioned later on in Tanakh, that many people, and you'll be surprised to see who notes it majestically here, and that is in Sefer Shoftim. Sefer Shoftim takes place by and large after the death of Yoshua. There are little bits of Sefer Shoftim that happen at the end of Yoshua's career, and the first chapter and a half of Shoftim is a little bit of a time warp back and forth to the end of Yoshua's career and after Yoshua died. But the beginning of Shoftim is clearly after Yoshua died, because it starts with Vayhi Acharei Mot Yoshua. And in that first chapter is a description of all the land conquered by the tribes, chiefly to point out the land they didn't conquer. It's the dark side of Sefer Yoshua, the part we didn't get. Asher lohorishet Yoshvei Achlav, and etc. And Ephraim lohorishet this, and Zvulun lohorishet Nahalol, the Kitron. All the cities they didn't conquer, Ephraim lohorishet Gezer. But it starts with Yehuda, and Yehuda, by the way, takes two allies with them. Who were the two allies of Yehuda? Shevet Shimon, who gets land inside of Yehuda, and the Keni. Remember the Keni? Chovab's descendants, who had led up settling in the north Sinai, and then there's a breakaway who moved north, and there's a fellow named Chever, who's a member of the breakaway, whose wife's name is Yael, who's really good with a hammer and tent peg. Okay, that's the Keni. So at the beginning of Shoftim, we hear that Yehuda takes Shimon and the Keni, and they come in as allies. I'll help you conquer, you help me conquer, we'll conquer together. And it's all in the south. Now, watch what happens in passage 5. Vayelch Yudat Shimon Achiv, Vayakuta Knaani Yoshev Tzfat. This is not our Tzfat. Clearly, it's in the south. Vayachrimota, here we go, Vayikra et Shem Ha'ir Chorma. The name of the city they conquer is Chorma. It's the only other place called Chorma that we know of, besides the one mentioned in
Chukat. Does Vayikra mean they called it, they named it, or does it mean they already had an embassy?
Typically it means they named it. Sometimes it can be renamed it, like you have that with Beersheba, getting named three times if they're all the same place. Right, Ad Hayom Hazeh, the famous thing about Beersheba. You can have the same thing with Gilgal, but here we have no reason to think it's different because V'achrimu ota, V'akra Hashem Ha'ir Chorma. The problem is, if it had already been destroyed, there's nothing to destroy. So you have to assume that they're the ones who destroyed it, and then they named it Chorma because it was a dedicated city to God. Alright? So that raises this very interesting problem. Take a look, starting with the Ibn Ezra.
How do we know it's the same city? Maybe that's just a generic name for dedicated cities.
That would work if we found others. You're right. And certainly Rashi and the Bechor Shor and other Bishonim who read these, this is not being related to our event, are going to read it that way.
Yeah.
They'll say there's other cities named Korma,
right,
and there's another one of them. Matter of fact, you could even say that in, how do you call it, in Shoftim, they're simply following a model that already existed in Parshat Chukat.
Right.
Absolutely. Take a look at the Ibn Ezra. The Ibn Ezra says, Amru HaKod Nonim Shu Sichon, that the Kanani actually is Sichon. Nikra Kanani, Kikola Mori Kanani, because they're all Kanani. Rabim Amru, look at the Ibn Ezra. Ki Zota Parsha Yehoshua Katava. Here we go. Now, this is the Ibn Ezra, so we're not surprised. Because the Ibn Ezra is the grandfather of the 12 Sukkim at the end of the Torah, not the 8 that is in the Breita, but the 12 Sukkim at the end of the Torah, and the beginning of Sefer Dvarim, and Akarni Az Ba'aret, and Bahar Hashem Yeirah, and several other passages here and there that Ibn Ezra is very comfortable saying this was written by Yeshua or somebody later. Right?
How does that help?
What?
How does that help?
Because he'll argue that this story by the way, he's not supporting it. Notice what the Ibn Ezra says. V'haraya Melech Arad Echad. His proof is from the fact that Melech Arad is mentioned in Yehoshua as one of the 31 kings. You know that Baskin Robbins list of Melech Yericho Echad, Melech, right? So Melech Arad Echad. So when was Melech Arad killed? He's killed as part of the Yehoshua war. So what's he doing in Chukat? He must have been added later by Yehoshua. That's the argument.
So it's a story from the future inside Bamidbar?
What?
It's a story that happens in Yehoshua's time?
That's written into Bamidbar, right. That's what the Ibn Ezra is quoting somebody as saying.
Do we have other instances?
In other words, these people bring a proof from the, and by the way, this is the Ibn Ezra. So you shouldn't be that surprised. In other words, if the Ibn Ezra was to adopt this position, you wouldn't be surprised at all, because the Ibn Ezra comfortably says, although very discreetly and very enigmatically, he won't say it explicitly, but he says, you know, at the beginning of Dvarim, he says, if you understand the story of the last 12 Sukkim, then you'll understand this also. And you look at the last 12 Sukkim, and Perek Lamed Daled Pasuk Aleph of Dvarim, he says, Lefi da'ati mikan ve'elch Yehoshua katab. Not the last 8 when Moshe dies, but the last 12 when Moshe goes to the top of the mountain, because he says, Moshe never came down to give us the rest. And therefore it had to be that Yehoshua wrote it, Bederech Nevuah. And so he quietly throws that approach into all sorts of sporadic passages, not even Pesukim, phrases that show up in other parts of the Torah, but here he rejects it. And he says, Velo Amru Klum. Right? He's rejecting this approach. Ki oto makom yikare b'tchilat Tzfat v'ze melech Arad v'hemet shnei makomot v'rabim mikra kamohem. So he says something akin to what you were saying, which is that this isn't all the same place. But he's not arguing that Chorma might be a generic name given to any place that's destroyed. And by the way, that is true. And this may be what he means, v'rabim b'mikra kamohem, that there are lots of places in there's names of places in Tanakh that are used in multiple places. Beit Lechem, there's 3 of. Gilgal, there's at least 5 of. Ramah, there's at least 3 of. There's also places because they're named based on certain topographical or agricultural things. That, and we don't care, that's Beit Lechem Yehuda, Beit Lechem Binyamin, doesn't bother us. Ramat Ephraim, Ramat Binyamin, right? It doesn't bother us. And so he said, therefore, you're right, Chorma, but he doesn't say it that way. He says, look at the words. In Shoftim, they talk about a city called Sfat, that they then changed to Chorma. And here, it evidently is something about Arad. But by the way, that means that Ibn Ezra's owning up, that it's the city of Arad that we're talking about, not on the East Bank. Which, of course, brings up that same problem of the location. The Bechor Shor here says where he says that it's the Mapilim in passage 7. I want to show you the Ramban, because the Ramban is just mind-blowing. Because the Ramban. Again, it's, you know, we take the truth from where we find it. That's the Rambam's Hanchaya, we always follow it. If somebody says something that works and fits and is well anchored, then we're ready to examine it seriously. And we're not so concerned with the author. But when you find a particular author taking a position that runs counter to everything we know about the author, then it's surprising. This is the Ramban. We love the Ramban. Okay, let's take a look at the Ramban. V'anachon be'inat. Hizem melech harad hu yoshev b'negev me'ivel le'odein yama. So this king, he lives on the West Bank in the Arad that we know. Okay, it's not that far from Drom Har Chevron. So his take, though, is that he heard that they were coming, so he crossed to the east bank to go to war, because Ram Yisrael is coming, what we call a preemptive war. That's what the Vayishma is, that he heard from a distance and he came. That's why it says he lives in the Negev to tell you, but he left. Meaning, he lives there, but he came here to fight us because we're on the east bank. Now that means, of course, according to the Ramban and many, the geography of Bnei Yisrael's travels have them skirting the Negev. Not everybody agrees. And many will suggest that we actually went right through the Negev and right near Arad on our way to Moab, and that then we came around, right? Now, v'nadru Yisrael neder l'Hashem. They took a neder. She'im yitain oto bi'adam she'achrimu kol ha'shalayim l'Hashem. What was the neder? That if Hashem helps them win this war, they're going to give everything that they conquer to Hashem. V'siper ha'katuv. Get ready for this. Ki shama Hashem tefilatam v'nadru neder l'Hashem v'shimu oto. God listened to their prayer, they made a neder, and they fulfilled their neder. Kargu otam atabi me Moshe. They killed him in Moshe's time, meaning they won the war and they got the captive back in Moshe's time. Kemosh tiva kocher Moshe yachram, etc. V'natnu kos pam notzar beit Hashem. V'yishlim od b'cham l'saper. But not all that means is that they destroyed their cities, meaning everything till the end of the pasuk. V'yishlim od b'cham l'saper. Then what does the text add on? Keachrimu Yisrael gamet areyam achrei boam be'eretz Canaan. After they came into the land, they also destroyed the rest of the cities of the Arad. Meaning, what happened? They, Arad, came to the east bank. Bnei Yisrael make a neder, Hashem helps, and they win. So they beat them up, and they get their captives back. But they made a neder. What was their neder? If you help me win, what am I going to do? I'm going to destroy their cities. Where are their cities? On the west bank. On the west bank. So he says, therefore the text finishes the story. And what's the end of the story? That they then, when they came into Eretz Yisrael, acharei mot Yehoshua, listen to this, acharei mot Yehoshua, they fulfilled the neder that they had taken two generations ago. They took a neder in Moshe's time. If you help me beat these people up, we will destroy their cities and make them cherem. And when they finally came in, and after Yehoshua died, then Shevet Yehuda was able to conquer, then they fulfilled it. And they call it Arim Chorma. They call the whole area Chorma. And he quotes the whole pasuk in Shoftim. Whoa. What's the Ramban saying? The Ramban is saying simply this. If the pasuk was just telling us what happened in this time, it would have ended four words earlier. Look back at the top thing on the page, the last pasuk. Actually, stop there. The minute it's vet arehem, vayikrashim makom chorma, that's something that doesn't happen for two more generations. The Ramban says, so the Torah wants to finish the story. Wait a second, the story didn't happen yet. The Torah wants to finish the story, but the story is being told in the past tense, and the story didn't happen yet.
Is that like Luz Beidel?
So, no, because that's all happened in the past. Okay, sorry. And then the Ramban says the following. So that's why I quoted Source 9. Source 9, we talked about this in the same point from a different angle a while ago, and that is the story of the man. When does the story of the man take place? So I gave you the first pasuk. When did the whole story of the man start? On the 15th of Iyar, a month after leaving Egypt. Matzah lasted for a month, and then they ran out of matzah, and they got hungry, etc., etc. We all know the story, right? Okay. After the whole thing goes, and this we talked about the Shabbatot, how many Shabbatot there were, and Mamar Sinai, etc. After the whole story ends, we're still pre-Matan Torah, we've had a couple Shabbatot, we've had the lesson of the man, and we move on. What happens at the end of the story of the man in Beshalach? Remember, that's in the middle of Shmot. Take a vial and put one omer of man into the vial, into the jar. Put it in front of God forever. What does in front of God mean?
Didn't we say there's an altar?
What altar?
That was related to Shabbos that we said.
No? So maybe that's what we're being Mekayim by having Lecha Mishnah, right. But what's Pshat here? So we find out what Pshat is, and it's mind blowing because it says, "Kasher tzivah Adonai Moshe v'nechel Aaron lifnei ha'edut l'mishmaret." What does Aaron do to fulfill that? He puts it in front of the edut. What's the edut? The Luchot Abrit. Where are the Luchot Abrit? Inside the Aaron. Where's the Aaron? In the Kodesh Kedoshim of the Mishkan. In Parsha B'Shalach. Ribono Shalom. What are we doing here?
Haven't built it yet.
So the answer, we haven't been heard about it yet. There is no Mishkan. There's no Aron. There's no Edut. Edut means testimony. Testimony to what? Matan Torah didn't happen yet. So clearly, these psukim are being written later. Not a problem. Moshe Rabbeinu writes the Torah before he dies, and he tells the story of the man, and at the end of the story of the man, he says, by the way, here's how the man played out. A little while later, we built a Mishkan, and Aron was told by Moshe at that point to put some man there. He did. But that part is fine. The problem is the next pasuk. Uvnei Yisrael achlu et haman 40 shana. How long did Bnei Yisrael eat the man for?
38 and a
half years. No, 40 years is right. 40 years is right, minus a month. Minus a month. Yet. But 40 years itself shouldn't exist.
We don't
just
know.
Say, fine. I'm still no problem. Just like the Mishkan part is written later, the 40 years written. I mean, Moshe Rabbeinu writes his Sefer Torah at the end. He doesn't write at the beginning. Writes Sefer Torah at the end. So at the end, he writes Sefer Torah, and in it he says, hey, let's finish the story of the man. By the way, we ate it, put it in the Mishkan, and we ate it for 40 years. Until when?
Moshe does.
After they crossed the Jordan.
Until after they crossed the Jordan. That's the problem. Right? At Haman Achlu, they ate the man until they were already inside of Canaan.
How would Moshe know that?
Exactly. Now, Moshe can know it. I got no problem with Nevuah. What I have a problem with is past tense being written, future being written as past tense. So take a look at the Ramban, where we were in source 8. And he brings this as another example. Vizek inyana parsha shamra bereta taman. And he quotes the whole thing, both about the Mishkan and also about the 40 years. And I quote the pasuk in source 10. They ate the man until after the Pesach was brought, a month after Moshe died. Right? That is a little bit different. Because in Parshat Maaseh, Hashem tells Moshe, the following are the 12 people who are going to work with Elazar and Yoshua to divide up the land. And of course, you know, we haven't gotten there yet. And who says they're all going to be alive? So he says, "Ki lo yitachen shi'a Hashem yachin lemanashim al safek, aval haya ra'ui shi'itzaveh le'Yoshua be'eta chalukah." All right, nevuah yuchayim yuchayimim. So what he says about those 12 is a nevuah that they're going to be alive. But notice which issues he particularly skirts, and I think that he is very, very quietly saying, "I'm signing on with Ibn Ezra here." He skirts the issue of the last pasuk about the man. I mean, not the last, but the second to last pasuk. Pasuk Lamed Hei, about the man. Again, the problem with the Mishkan is easy. Moshe Rabbeinu writes the Torah before he dies, and at that point, there's been a Mishkan, and the man's been sitting in front of it, and that's all gezunt. But writing the pasuk about having eaten the man until after we crossed in the past tense is a problem. What did Rabbi Yehuda famously say about that in the last 8 pasukim of the Torah? Since it says Moshe died in the past tense. So Rabbi Yehuda says, therefore I have to be written by Yoshua. So when the Ibn Ezra here says, and this is also at the end of Dvarim, Mamad Dalet, adds in those two words, B'derach Nevuah, and I believe that that's what the Ramban is hinting to here. Bottom line, you're going to run into Sukkim, and Chukat is like a mother load for this, of Sukkim that seem to be hinting to stuff that happens later, including stuff that happens perhaps after Moshe dies, like this Chorma problem. And we have the same thing with B'Shalach, which, by the way, interestingly enough, the man comes up in our parsha also, is that it seems that underneath, comfortably saying, you know what? Okay, so Yeshua wrote it. I'm not. The bottom line, what is our real concern? What's the bottom line concern? Bottom line concern is this Dvar Hashem. It is Dvar Hashem. And if it's Dvar Hashem, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Yeshua ben Nevuah, add these 3 words in, or these 8 psukim in, or these 12 psukim in, etc., about Moshe's death, or add these words in to show that Bnei Israel fulfilled their neder in your day with Chorman, or that the man lasted all the way until they actually came into Canaan and had food to eat after the death of Moshe. Hazoy. The concern is not who the scribe is. The concern, who's the author? Author, capital A. So if the scribe for a couple psukim or a couple passages happens to be Yehoshua as opposed to Moshe, that's not what bothers us. Now, there are, and this is something that I'm just going to whet your appetite with and not go further, is that the way that a particular parshan will address this problem is almost totally driven by the parshan's audience. And you understand why. If a parshan is writing in a, it doesn't exist, in a totally ivory tower environment where anything, you could say anything comfortably and you're not afraid that anybody might misuse your words or misconstrue your words and come up with some really screwy results, then it's wide open. It doesn't exist. It does not exist. And therefore you find consistently, I can show you parshan achar parshan, where what they're saying, what they're not saying, the way they're saying it is very much with awareness of their responsibility towards their audience and who's listening and how it's going to be used. You look at those parshanim who operated in the environment of Karaism, and the way that they approach Psukim is very, very different than, for instance, Franco-German Pashtanim who are operating in an environment of interaction with Christians, with the resurgence of an interest in Pshat of the 12th century of the church, suddenly looking at the words of the text. And that's why there's so much polemic in the commentaries of the Franco-German Rishonim against early Christianity, because in that era, the Christians are looking at the Bible and looking at the actual words. And that's where the polemics come in. As opposed to what you're finding in the world of Sfarad, where there's a whole other kind of challenge that's going on from the Muslim attack, which is the attack of forgery, etc. And so as a result of that, you have to learn to read very, very carefully and see what they're saying and what they're not saying. And notice what Ramban does not say here about this. He does not come out and say, and Moshe Rabbeinu wrote this benevoah that they're going to destroy the cities of Chorma, or that the manna is going to be eaten until that point. And I believe, I'm not willing to can't put any money on this, but I believe that the Ramban here is really comfortably signing on. But he's not the only one. I'll just show you one other quick thing. Turn the page. I'm not going to show you the chazik because that's way too long, and we did it a few years ago. But if you look at the very top of the page, you'll find the last part is Pasuk and Chukat. And this is summer, so I got to tell you a camp story. It's the last Pasuk and Chukat. I told you, Chukat's a landmine. How do you call it? Goldmine for this. Also seems to hint to that. And this is a passage that's actually easiest to teach in L.A. more than anywhere else. Because in L.A., where do you live?
In the flats or the hills.
What? So where do you live? You live in the hood, right? It was in the valley. It doesn't count, but right. But there are people I know of that actually live on what we call the other side of town. Now, what's the other side of town?
A couple of blocks away.
The other side of town is wherever you're not. Wherever you're not. So I remember one Friday, my wife was picking up at Yavne. Our kids go to Yavne. Yavne is on the other side of town. My wife's picking up at Yavne. And we're actually going to be coming home. And they're going back for Shabbat. We're going to spend Shabbat in Hancock Park. And somebody said, where are you going to be for Shabbat? She says, the other side of town. So, that's too bad. We would have had you over. No, we're going to be here, the other side of town. The other side of town is a relative term. That is the easiest way to explain a phrase that shows up in Chumash and throughout Tanakh, which is confusing. And the phrase is, Eiver HaYarden. What does Eiver HaYarden mean? The other side. What's the other side? Wherever you're not. The reason I'm mentioning that is because, and I told you a camp story, so 9 years ago, we spent this delightful, fantastic summer in yet another Rosh Hashanah in Ennismore, and I met one of the staff members, had the last name Lakshin. It's not a last name that you forget. On visiting day, her father came up, and I had an opportunity to meet him, introduce himself, and just very simply go, Marty Lakshin is probably the world expert on the Rashbam. So because I knew his name, the next time that I saw his commentary on the Rashbam, I opened it up, and I just happened to open up to this comment. Take a look at the last pasuk in Chukat. Now, where are Bnei Yisrael? This is the end of Chukat. This is pre-Balak, just before the setup for Balak. So where are Bnei Yisrael? East side or west side? East side, right? Me'aver le'Yarden Yericho, on the other side of the Yarden from Yericho. That's the east side. Okay, so look at the Rashbam. Ra'ui le'katev me'aver le'Yarden lo'tam shavru et ha'Yarden. Who calls it me'aver le'Yarden? If you're on the east bank, who's going to call you on the other side? People have already crossed, right? Shalahem karu Arvot Moab me'ever le'Yarden. Right? Arvot Moab is the other side. If you're on the east side, Arvot Moab is here. So in his notes he claimed, I'm not saying 100% convinced, but I think there's reason to think that the Rashbam here is also making the same suggestion, is that the phrase me'ever le'Yarden yurecho may be what Lyman refers to as a gloss. Right? Now a gloss, of course, and this is the core issue. The core issue is, who's responsible for the gloss? And the gloss, the responsibility for the gloss is the responsibility of a Navi. Of a Navi. And if HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, here's what I want you to put into this phrase to clarify it, to make it clear for the people who are on the West Bank. Now, is that the only way to read the Rashbam? Not necessarily. The Rashbam could be saying that the Torah now is writing it for a perspective for later, so that you see me every other day. But not necessarily the case. The reality is that almost all of classical Rishonim, in one way or the other, skirt around and seem to come close to this particular issue. But again, none of them, and I'm even not saying it as explicitly as could be said, none of them say it as explicitly and as billboard, in a billboard kind of way. And again, I think the main consideration really is who the audience is and what the audience is going to do with that approach.